So whenever you're ready, Adam.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Adam Eisenberg. I'm the Assistant General Counsel for Fisheries with NOAA's Office of General Counsel in Silver Spring. And I'm here today on behalf of the Fisheries Service Sustainable Fisheries Division to talk about the agency's proposed rule to streamline the NEPA process. As I'm sure most of you know, the Magnuson-Stevens Reauthorization Act requires the agency, in consultation with the councils and the Council on Environmental Quality, to revise its procedures for implementing the National Environmental Policy Act with respect to fishery management actions. And the statute specifies that the revision should essentially do two things: conform the timelines of NEPA with the MSA, and integrate the various analytical procedures that apply to fishery management actions. Over the past year and a half or so, we have engaged in a process with both the councils and with CEQ and developed this proposed rule. In preparing the proposed rule, there were several goals that we tried to adhere to. And the first goal, of course, was to comply with the mandates of both statutes, with both Magnuson Act and NEPA. In addition, we tried to adhere to the principles of public involvement and agency accountability that appear in the NEPA regulations. And we tried, the next three bullets, I think, are all related. We attempted to integrate NEPA into the Magnuson Act public processes. The Council Coordinating Committee, which is a committee consisting of the council chairs and executive directors of all of the councils, met in early January 2007, after the Magnuson Reauthorization Act was passed, and appointed a subcommittee that developed a straw man proposal and presented that proposal to the Fisheries Service and CEQ. And we took a very close look at that proposal. We spent 2 days meeting with the subcommittee, discussing their proposal and discussing the council's goals with respect to gaining efficiencies in the NEPA process. And we tried to build on the recommendations of the CCC straw man. We didn't adopt it wholesale, but I think we really tried to kind of meet the objectives of the straw man and build on the recommendations of the straw man proposal. And we tried to clarify the responsibilities of the Fishery Management Councils and the Fisheries Service and align the public participation according to the roles of each of those participants in the development and implementation of fishery management actions. I think the underlying theme throughout this proposal is that we attempted to recognize the Council's unique role in the development of fishery management measures and to incorporate the Council process at appropriate points in the NEPA process. And then finally, we attempted to ensure that the new procedures would allow flexibility to react rapidly to urgent and changing management needs, while still ensuring that the public would have a meaningful opportunity to provide their input into policy decisions. With respect to the approach we took, we started with the existing CEQ regulations as the vehicle for the revised procedures and revised those CEQ regulations and proposed changes where necessary to address problems that had been identified by the councils, identified by other commenters, or that we ourselves perceived. While still retaining the essence of the CEQ regulations and the heart of the NEPA process. In addition, if you examine the proposal, you'll notice that there is some reorganization that was largely for clarity. There are things that are moved around, but that are that were in the existing CEQ regulations. We also tried to work within the parameters of the CEQ regulations to allow flexibility while still retaining limits on that flexibility and providing guidance on how to exercise that flexibility. And finally, we reserved making any changes in the existing NOAA administrative order that contains agency procedures. Whether or not we make additional changes in that guidance will be determined in after the comment period closes and the final regulation is drafted, and we determine what types of additional changes might be appropriate in the internal guidance. There were key changes in four areas from the existing CEQ regulations. The first is in the area of content. The proposed rule retains the basic content requirements for analysis, but makes specific modifications to address fisheries issues and to recognize certain elements of the Magnuson Act. And I'll talk about all four of these in a little more detail, but as an overview, the second is documentation. It retains the environmental assessment FONSI that is familiar to everyone. One of the proposals in the CCC straw man had been to eliminate the EA and FONSI. We have retained that because we believe it allows maximum flexibility. We've also retained the categorical exclusion, but we've also developed some new forms of documentation that we hope will allow additional flexibility, streamline NEPA compliance, and avoid creating paper solely for the sake of creating paper where it's not necessary, while still ensuring that there are adequate analyses where it is necessary. The third area of change is in public involvement. As I said, we've adapted the comment and response requirements to align them with the relative functions of the councils and the fisheries service. And finally, we've adapted the timelines to allow modification of some of the existing CEQ timelines to ensure that the councils are able to act within the Magnuson Act processes and to respond to urgent needs. On the first of those key changes, the content requirements, generally the proposed rule applies the same content requirements that exist for environmental impact statements currently under the CEQ regulations to the EIS equivalent, which is now termed an IFEMS, or an Integrated Fisheries Ecosystem Management Statement. The three primary changes with respect to content are in the areas of alternatives, incomplete or unavailable information, and cumulative impacts analysis. With respect to alternatives, there are two primary areas where we've offered clarifications. The first is that the proposal retains the requirement to consider all reasonable alternatives. This has been interpreted to be the heart of NEPA compliance, and we felt it was important to retain that requirement, but at the same time, we provided guidance on how to implement and interpret that provision. There's a new definition that discusses and defines reasonable and describes it as being derived from the statement of purposes and need, and clarifies that a alternative is not reasonable if it's inconsistent with the Magnuson Act and the national standards, if it's impractical or ineffective to achieve the purpose and need of the action, or if it fails to achieve the stated goals. The other area with respect to alternatives is that we offered additional guidance on the no-action alternative. As I'm sure you know, the CEQ regulations currently include a requirement to analyze a no-action alternative. Starting from the bottom of the three bullets there, the purpose of the no-action alternative is to provide a baseline against which the action can be judged and the effects of the various alternatives can be considered and analyzed. The proposal clarifies that the no-action alternative does not necessarily mean continued management of the fishery. That it means continued management of the fishery as it is being managed. That it does not mean literally a no-action. In other words, either that open access will follow or that closures will follow due to sunsets that may be in the fishery management plan. In some contexts, I believe there's been confusion as to how to interpret the no-action alternative. Fishery management plans vary in terms of what happens if certain management measures expire as to whether the default is an open access fishery or a default is complete closure. And this clarifies that neither of those situations is the no-action, should be the no-action alternative. The no-action alternative really should look at the fishery essentially as it's operating at the time the analysis is being conducted, and that is the basis for comparing the action under consideration. The next area is with respect to incomplete and unavailable information. The existing CEQ regulations have a provision that require that where incomplete or unavailable information is relevant to reasonably foreseeable effects, the agency is required to identify the information and obtain it if the cost of obtaining the information is not exorbitant. And what we've done in the proposal is attempt to put that in the context of National Standard 2, the best available science requirement, and other provisions of the Magnuson Act, and to explain that in determining exorbitance, it's important to look at the availability of appropriated funds, the research priorities as indicated by the Council's Science and Statistical Committees, to consider the costs of delay and the consequences of delaying action to obtain the information, and the inherent uncertainties of fishery management, including, among other things, the nature of stock assessments and the variability of and uncertainty of the information that is generally found in stock assessments.
Excuse me.
The third area with respect to content is cumulative impacts. The proposal specifically and explicitly incorporates a requirement to do a cumulative impacts analysis. This requirement is not currently in the CEQ regulations, but it is widely required by the case law. And so this change simply incorporates and acknowledges the requirements that exist according to the general case law interpreting NEPA. The next aspect of the proposed rule is with respect to forms of documentation. There are four basic types of documentation under the proposal. Three of them should be familiar, although two of those have a new name. The IFEMS, as I mentioned, is the new EIS. The proposal retains the EA and FONSI, the Environmental Assessment and Finding of No Significant Impact. And finally, the categorical exclusion. There's a new reference to a determination of categorical exclusion, which is primarily a formalization of the categorical exclusion process. And then there is a new type of documentation, a new process called a Memorandum of Framework Compliance, and I will primarily talk about that one. The proposal provides for establishing framework implementation procedures. This is essentially a form of tiering. And a framework implementation procedure is any formal mechanism established in a fishery management plan that allows an action to be undertaken based on a previously established management regime. I want to be clear here because I know that this council has a long-standing practice of utilizing frameworks, and frameworks is one of those things that has different meanings and to different people. I think all of you here probably have the same idea of what a framework is, but the term is used quite differently among the various councils. And so by using the term framework, we're talking about framework sort of in the generic sense, not specifically about what the New England Council might call a framework or what the Pacific Council, for example, might call a framework. But the important point here is that if utilized properly, establishing a framework implementation procedure will allow follow-on actions without requiring additional NEPA analysis. And I think that's an opportunity to really gain some efficiencies in your NEPA practice. The framework implementation procedures start essentially with a fishery management plan that sets up a management approach. That could be one of your frameworks, although not necessarily has to be, and then specifies the subsequent actions that will be taken or the category of actions that will be taken and the general parameters of those actions. This concept assumes that a analysis is done for those procedures and for certain bookends for future implementing procedures. And then at that point, if subsequent management actions and their effects fall within the scope of the prior analysis, there's no need to do an additional action-specific analysis. Instead, there would simply be prepared what we've called a memorandum of framework compliance evaluation. Just like the earlier presentation on ACLs, we've done our best to provide as many new acronyms as we can. But the framework compliance evaluation would basically do three things. It would identify the prior analysis that considered the action that is now being taken. It would identify any new information that is relevant to the follow-on action. And then it would briefly describe why the follow-on action is within the scope of the prior analysis. As the preamble to the proposed rule indicates, it is our expectation that these memos would generally be not more than two pages. So they would be very limited in scope. They would primarily be for the purpose of just ensuring that there's a record to demonstrate that the council and the agency were aware that there was a prior analysis and that they specifically identified that. The next major area is in terms of the opportunities for public involvement. I've already emphasized that one of the primary goals of the development of this process was to recognize the bifurcation of the responsibilities for fishery management actions among the agency and the councils, and to recognize the council's role in developing fishery management plans and amendments, and to recognize the secretary's role in approving and implementing those plans and implementing regulations, as well as the secretary's limited discretion in evaluating council recommendations and determining whether to approve or disapprove those recommendations. So the process provides two opportunities for public comment. One opportunity at the Fishery Management Council level on the draft IFMs, which essentially is a Fishery Management Council document. And then a second opportunity for public comment on the final IFMs at the secretarial review level. The proposal also specifies that comments on the scope of the action and the scope of the alternatives analyzed must be raised at the Fishery Management Council level, or they may not be raised later at the secretarial level when the secretary's role is limited to approving or disapproving the council's recommendation. That isn't to say that the public can't necessarily address the adequacy of the analysis at the council level in the final, but they can't come in at that point and say the council failed to consider an alternative if they did not first raise that alternative with the council. The next element is in terms of timelines. To accommodate the additional public comment, which occurs at the secretarial level at this stage, there was a need to provide some additional flexibility for reductions in comment periods based on specific conditions. And it's a very dense bullet point up there. I'm not going to read it. I'll let you take a look at it. But I think the essence of it is that in specific circumstances there are opportunities to reduce the comment period at the draft level as well as at the final level. And this was important to ensuring that actions could be completed in a two council meeting cycle where councils have specific needs to meet that type of schedule. I know that this council sometimes has to take action in two council meetings. Other councils have specifically set up their council schedule to their meeting schedule to deal with when information comes in so that they can provide annual specifications on a very short time frame. And this provision allows them to meet those schedules more efficiently. The next couple of slides I will leave for your later review. These are slides that provide some background on sort of how this process will flow. The document also makes some changes with respect to the need for supplementation of a draft IFOMS. This particularly applies in a context where the council may consider an alternative that was not analyzed in the draft that it has before it at the time that it takes action. The council may vote on a hybrid alternative that's a mix and match among various alternatives, or it might create a new alternative. And if those alternatives are within the range of analysis, no new analysis is required. This is the current rule. However, if the council votes for an alternative that is outside the range of the alternatives that were analyzed, supplementation is required for the new alternative. Again, this is currently the rule. But there are new options for how to deal with that situation. And at this point, the council has some discretion. The council can take additional public comment on the supplemental analysis at the council level and determine whether or not it wants to have an additional vote based on the revised analysis. Or the council can go ahead and decide to move forward with the action and do the supplementation along with the Fisheries Service, submit the supplemental analysis to the agency when it transmits the fishery management action. And in that case, the additional public comment will occur at the secretarial level, and there's no additional council vote. This allows more flexibility and allows the process to move forward without getting stuck in a loop where the council is continuously revising its analysis, bringing it back for a vote, and then potentially revising it again without sort of ever moving the documents forward. The next couple of slides elaborate on the timing of this option. I think the key point here is that in the event that the council chooses to move forward and submit the supplemental analysis with the expectation that the public comment will occur during the secretarial review stage, because of the 60-day period for review of fishery management actions, the secretary has very limited time to put the document out for public comment, and so it's critical to kind of specify how that comment period will occur to allow that to happen in the limited time available. The next steps, the rule was published, the proposed rule was published on May 14th, and the comment period will be open until August 12th. During the next couple of months, representatives for the Fisheries Service will be attending meetings of all of the councils, as I am today, and making the same presentation, doing our best to answer your questions. We will also be holding public meetings on the proposed rule in St. Petersburg, Florida, Seattle, and Washington, D.C. And then we will, of course, move on and take the public comment, consider the public comment, and do our best to address those comments and prepare a final proposal. The next page is just a guide for your reference. These are the sections that have the most significant changes, the changes that are most likely to be of interest. I want to be clear, these are not the only sections that have changes. Many of the changes are just to conform cross-references and that type of thing, but there are changes in other sections. In conclusion, as I've said, this proposal is really intended to meet the congressional mandate in the Magnuson Reauthorization Act to provide new tools for streamlining, to achieve efficiencies in the NEPA practice with respect to fisheries actions, to allow the process to move forward from the councils to NIMS for final decision, to align public participation at the appropriate points in the Magnuson-Stevens Act process, and to allow as much flexibility as possible to the councils and the agency in meeting the NEPA, the requirements of NEPA, while providing guidance on the limitations of that flexibility and retaining the core requirements of NEPA. Thank you, and I'm happy to try to answer any questions.
Thanks, Adam. Just to remind the council, the executive committee looked at this issue and talked about this new proposal. And certainly this council is part of one of the eight councils in its participation at the CCC meetings has been part of the development of this process and paid attention to it. The executive committee struggled to see the benefit of the new proposal and actually was concerned about the uncertainties that appear in the proposed rule, specifically concerned about the loss of institutional experience over the past 10 or 12 years that we have under the current way we do business. And we're worried that we could find ourselves vulnerable to more litigation through the adoption of these practices that are proposed. Additionally, some of the proposed changes that are here are already our current practice. So the genesis of this proposal wasn't born from this region. It was from somewhere else. And it was attempting to fix a problem that we didn't have. And it appears that in the process of trying to fix a problem we didn't have, it also created more questions. So those are just some general comments. Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm working my way through the document as well and finding it difficult to understand because I'm not a council staffer who has to deal with the intricacies of making sure that the council follows all the required administrative processes. So you've already indicated that I'm assuming that staff and the executive committee will put a great deal of time into this, you know, working with the regional office, with Gene, I suppose, to pose the questions and then to see if indeed we can get some answers to those questions. I'll ask this one. In going through the Federal Register, I note that it's indicated that there will be new duties on the management councils to consider public input before voting. Now, I didn't quite catch a description of that new duty in the presentation that you provided. Perhaps I just didn't understand it, but that Could you describe what those specific new duties entail?
Certainly. This slide, I think, references that, and I guess it's not clear in that it references the opportunities for comment, but doesn't isn't explicit that there's a corresponding requirement to respond to comment. And so under the process, as I indicated, the draft IFAMs occurs at the council level. So when the council when the council is ready to vote finally on an action, at that point it should have the draft IFAMs before it, and the public will have had an opportunity to comment on that, and the council is required under the proposal to respond to the comments. Now, I want to be clear that there are there's flexibility in the manner in which that that response to comments occurs. There's not necessarily a requirement to do the type of thing that the agency does in a proposed rule, for example, to identify each comment and provide a written response, but the council is required to consider the comments and take them into consideration. To the general points, I appreciate the concerns about uncertainties and questions with respect to the document, and we certainly hope that to the extent you think anything is unclear or there are any uncertainties, that in the comments that you provide, the written comments you provide those certainly, as with any document, there are places where it probably could be drafted better to answer some of those questions. And the other point is that to the extent that this council feels that, you know, it has systems that work, I don't think that this process particularly imposes significant burdens in continuing those processes. I think that it provides guidance and an opportunity for this council to achieve some efficiencies that it couldn't do before, perhaps with the framework compliance evaluation process. And also, as the chairman recognized, you know, other councils have had various experiences with their NEPA compliance, and so I think, you know, it is aimed at all of the councils, certainly, and is intended to help those councils that are having difficulty with their NEPA compliance.
Just a quick response. Okay, very good. You just indicated that the proposed rule does provide for flexibility in how the council will respond to public comment. My first read-through, it was unclear as to how much flexibility the councils would have. I thought that this proposed rule was creating a new process that we would have to follow that would make it extremely difficult for us to do business if we had to, respond to every comment in writing that was made in response to what we were proposing. And that's not the case. There's flexibility within the rules, you are saying. So good.
There is some flexibility with respect to how the councils take comments into consideration.
Thanks, Adam. That's one of my biggest concerns, is the way we do business now. I don't want anything to cause us to make an already cumbersome, lengthy document more cumbersome and lengthy. And, the documents are already confusing enough, and I don't want any more work on a process that we've developed over time here that works. And you said two things. You said, you know, we've got to respond to comments before we take our final vote. Then you said, well, you can consider the comments. And that's what we do now. We go out to public hearing on the draft EIS, and then afterwards staff makes any written comments are all packaged together. The oral comments are written down in summaries, the verbal comments. And then they package them by different areas. We receive so many, and explain to the whole council what the comments were. But we don't respond to them. The response to those comments is in the council's vote. So if that's going to change, that we have to do what the service does when they finally submit a proposed rule and respond to comments, then we really don't want to do this. And our comments are going to be much stronger that we don't support this rather than, you know, we don't see any benefit to it. So can you, at this point, after all this time, you must know, do we have to respond to comments or can we just consider them and vote like we've been doing under NEPA for 30 years?
I think it is sufficient to take the comments into consideration. As you say, your vote is a response to the comments. You know, there needs to be some record that the comments are taken into account in some way.
Anyone else on the council? Thanks, Adam. I think that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
It's time to talk about harbor porpoise.